The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hi, welcome to Short Circuit. This is Clark Neely filling in for John Ross with a special guest, Steve Laddick, American University law professor and expert in national security law and the federal courts. Steve's here today to talk to us about an important decision from the D.C. Circuit involving the jurisdiction of military commissions at Guantanamo Bay and whether they have the authority to try individuals for purely domestic crimes. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Clark. It's great to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, let's talk about this case. I know from some of the things that you've posted online that you consider it to be perhaps the most important case that the D.C. Circuit has handed down involving the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I actually think it's the most important case involving military commissions in any federal court, really, since they were created in 2001, and that includes the 2006 Supreme Court case in Hamdan. The basic question in Al-Balul is actually the question that has loomed over the military commissions from their inception, which is whether these non-Article III federal courts, these military courts staffed by military judges designated for that position by the president, can preside over war crimes trials for offenses that aren't actually international war crimes, for offenses that are domestic offenses. There's pretty well-settled precedent from the Supreme Court from World War II that it's okay for a military commission to try an international war crime, so the 9/11 attacks, attacking civilian targets, and so on. The problem is that most of the commissions at Gitmo have been focused on non-international war crimes, on domestic offenses like inchoate conspiracy as a standalone offense or providing material support to terrorism. And the question that has been making its way through the courts over the past, really, 14 years is whether that's consistent with Article 3 of the Constitution. What the D.C. Circuit said on June 12th is that the answer is no.
So let's take a step back. What is the point of having military commissions? Why can't these crimes be handled in ordinary civilian courts?
So I think actually these crimes can be handled in ordinary Article III courts, but that the commissions provide advantages that make them attractive to the executive branch even over the available Article III courts. One of those advantages, obviously, is security. It's a lot easier to control the facility at Guantanamo to ensure that it's not subject to attack from potential terrorist plots, that you have controlled access from the witnesses, from the defendants, from the lawyers, et cetera. Also, perhaps a little bit easier to control the procedural and evidentiary rules insofar as the Constitution allows you to control them. You have military judges as opposed to civilian judges. The jurors, such as they are members of the military. They're not rank-and-file citizens. And in theory, they would be more efficient. That was the idea behind the commissions as they were originally created. That's more than a little ironic, given that here we are 14 years later. There have been 8 convictions, 7 of which are now vulnerable because of this D.C. Circuit ruling, and the Article III courts continue prosecuting terrorists on a daily basis.
Okay, so there are significant differences between an Article III jury trial and a trial before a military commission, correct?
There are. And I think the most important for our purposes are the procedural and evidentiary rules. Insofar as evidence is concerned, there's much more flexible use of hearsay, for example, in a military commission than a civilian court. From the procedural perspective, there's not nearly as well-settled precedence with regard to the defendant's rights, with regard to the defendant's lawyer's ability to go interview witnesses and to access certain testimony. And so all of these issues, although they tilt increasingly toward the civilian courts, the rules have increasingly merged with the civilian rules. Everything has to be reinvented each time because there's no precedent. There's no body of law. And so I think that's part of why these commissions, even if they might look fair on paper, have taken so long and have looked so fraught along the way.
So as I read the Al-Balul opinion, one of the important dynamics is the fact that these commissions are trying really 2 different categories of crimes. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that's what the Military Commissions Act of 2006, the statute Congress passed after the Supreme Court's Hamdan decision, sets up. So the MCA actually has 30 different substantive offenses that it empowers the commissions to try, 2/3 of which are, classic war crimes, murder in violation of the laws of war, attacking civilian targets, perfidy, the kinds of things that we tried after World War II and that the Supreme Court said it was permissible to try. But there's this category of offenses, including inchoate conspiracy, so conspiracy as a standalone crime, providing material support to terrorism, solicitation, that the MCA allows the military commissions to try, but that have never been recognized as international war crimes. And it's the trial of those offenses that has raised these constitutional questions. And I think the most important point to understand about the commissions is the cases in which these domestic offenses are the charges are not the outliers. Rather, those are the most common charges in the commissions. It's cases like the 9/11 trial, where the principal charges are clearly established international war crimes, that are the exception.
So to summarize, the problem, or at least the legal issue here, is that the majority of prosecutions going forward in the military commissions down in Guantanamo Bay involve domestic offenses that would normally be tried in an Article III civilian court, correct?
That's exactly right.
All right. So what's the legal issue?
So the legal issue, and I mean, I guess it's a little complicated because we've taken 14 years to get here. The first legal issue was whether Congress could create this system retroactively. Congress passed the MCA in 2006. Most of the Guantanamo detainees were already in custody by then, and so most of the underlying conduct giving rise to the charges predated the MCA. So there was a round of litigation over the ex post facto clause that culminated with an en banc decision by the D.C. Circuit last summer, in which the D.C. Circuit said, well, this particular defendant, Al Balul, had actually forfeited his ex post facto claim. And so applying plain error, the very deferential standard of review when criminal defendants forfeit their claims, the D.C. Circuit still said solicitation and material support were plainly erroneous to be tried in a military commission because it was just so clear that those weren't international war crimes that they couldn't be tried by military commissions before 2006. But they left conspiracy intact. And so what the D.C. Circuit held this month, 2 weeks ago, was that even without the ex post facto problem, trying inchoate conspiracy in a non-Article III military commission violates Article III because it is too far of a departure from the constitutional presumption that federal criminal cases are tried in Article III courts with Article III judges.
So again, to summarize, the holding a couple weeks ago of the D.C. Circuit is that this defendant, Al Balul, if you're going to try him for a domestic offense like conspiracy, it needs to be in an Article III civilian court, correct?
That's exactly right.
All right. So the opinion garnered a lengthy dissent from Judge Henderson. Can you just sort of summarize the highlights of Judge Henderson's dissent?
Sure. I mean, so it was a divided opinion. You had Judge Judith Rogers and David Tatel in the majority. Judge Karen Henderson filed an 85-page dissent, which is a bit uncommon even for the D.C. Circuit. And her argument, I think, is worth underlining because it's very interesting. It's basically that courts should take a functional approach to the constitutional question of whether we can depart from Article III. And if you look at this case functionally, conspiracy is a very specific offense. This is not a large number of cases. The military commission's primary objective, she says, is to try international war crimes. And so given the deference we historically give to Congress and the exercise of its war powers, this just doesn't seem like that radical a departure from Article III, and certainly not so radical as to prompt the majority to throw out this conviction.
And it seems to me that the looming question here is, what limits, if any, are there on Congress's ability to force defendants into, or at least to have defendants tried before a military commission, which features, the sort of lack of procedural protections and the relaxed evidentiary rules that you mentioned earlier? What limits, if any, are there on the ability of Congress to make people go before military commissions, according to Judge Henderson's dissent?
Well, I think according to Judge Henderson's dissent, there aren't that many limits. I mean, the approach she takes is that this is really a functional inquiry that looks at the overall volume of cases. And so the limit, I imagine, would be transcended if all of a sudden Congress were sending hundreds of cases into the military commissions for domestic offenses. The reason why, at least in my view, that argument's not particularly compelling is because if you look at the history of the commissions to date, their dominant proposition, their dominant class of cases has been domestic offenses and not international war crimes. I think the government's position, which is a bit narrower, is a little more defensible. And the government says, no, you can't try any domestic offense in a non-Article III military commission. Rather, you can try those domestic offenses that have a factual nexus to armed conflict, to the conflict that is justifying the use of these law of war military commissions.
So this, Evan, this seems to smack of a very important judicial engagement theme, which is that the government seems to be inching its way towards an essentially unfettered power. Congress essentially saying, hey, trust us, we'll be the determinants of our own power.
Yeah, I mean, Judge Henderson's dissent emphasizes deference, strong deference to the political branches over and over again. And as Clark points out, with the lack of a limiting principle, it's not clear how Judge Henderson's reasoning wouldn't leave Congress and the executive to be the constitutional judge of the scope of their own powers. Is that fair to say?
I think so, although I do think it's worth pointing out that at least for Judge Henderson, it really matters in this case that the defendants are non-citizens outside the United States. And so she even goes on to say later in her lengthy dissent that even if that all these things weren't true, Mr. Al-Baloul doesn't have Sixth Amendment jury trial rights, and so we can do whatever we want to him anyway. I'm not sure that follows. I don't think it follows that just because he's a non-citizen outside the U.S., we could summarily execute him. But I do think for her, the principal constraint would be that we would never do this to U.S. persons, to U.S. citizens. You know, I guess I'm not as sanguine as she is that in a future crisis, Congress wouldn't reach for power like this if it were left intact.
Yeah, I mean, what the majority seems to do, they take a very formal approach. They say, if this is not an offense against the laws of war, then it's not something that can be tried by a law of war commission. Whereas the dissent takes a, well, it's difficult to get a handle of just what and under what circumstances Congress could define and try a particular offense, even if it was a purely domestic offense, in a law of war commission.
I think that's right. I do think that this is a problem that is larger than the military commissions. I think we see the same concern in the Supreme Court's current jurisprudence regarding other non-Article III federal adjudications, so for example, bankruptcy courts. The critical difference to me, at least, is all of those other cases arise in a civil context, right? And where you have criminal prosecutions, I'm that much more concerned about finding the limiting principle that you're worried about, Evan, right? And about making sure that there are constraints on the power of the political branches.
Right, because this isn't just an abstract Article III structural problem. We're talking about something with direct ramifications for people's rights and their entitlements to an Article III adjudicator.
And I think it's really easy for folks to sit back and say, well, it's Guantanamo, it's non-citizens overseas, it's not about me. I think it's really worth pointing out that these are the very kinds of precedents that, if left untouched, would empower Congress in the future to say, oh, well, we took that step then, we can take the next step in the next crisis.
And again, Evan, that's something we've seen in other areas of constitutional law is this sort of incremental move towards power. It's a kind of a ratchet where it seems that the power of the government constantly expands and very rarely contracts.
Right. Once the courts have signed off on one exercise of congressional power in one context, the next challenge that comes up, we already set the precedents, and the result is the expansion of the power of the political branches.
And it's interesting. I mean, when the last time the Supreme Court had a really significant Article III case before this term, when they had the Wellness versus Sharif case, in Stern versus Marshall a couple of years ago, Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion actually went out of its way to say part of why we police Article III's bounds so carefully is because it's very hard to resist this kind of incrementalism on a case-by-case basis. And so we shouldn't be so quick to jump into functional analyses in this area where, in an individual case, it might not look like that big of an erosion of civil liberties to allow a military commission or a non-Article III bankruptcy court. But if you allow it in each case, you look back 5-10 years later, and all this power has been arrogated by the legislature away from the courts.
All right, so it's kind of death by a thousand cuts.
Exactly.
Or bushels of wheat in Wicker v. Filburn. Or bushes in Raich v. Gonzalez. Or Gonzalez v. Raich. So let's do a little bit of tea leaf reading. Where does this go? So I think there are two issues. One is, what does the government do? Do they try to take this case en banc, or do they go to the U.S. Supreme Court? And second, if the ruling stands, what does this mean for military commissions going forward?
So let's take those in order. On the question of whether the government pursues further review, you know, I think any effort at en banc review is going to be fairly pointless given who was on this panel. You know, Judith Rogers and David Tatel are, you know, not that conservative, but they're certainly in the middle of the current competition of the D.C. Circuit. I don't know where the 6 votes come from that the government would need to take this case en banc in the D.C. Circuit. That doesn't mean they won't try. The real question, and this has been a question that's been looming for really the better part of 5 years now, and we know there's been a fight within the Obama administration on this precise question, is whether the power of military commissions to try domestic offenses is an issue they want to take to the Supreme Court. What we've been led to believe is that the Solicitor General's office thinks the answer is that no, but that the National Security Division, the Defense Department, and perhaps even some in the White House think this issue is worth fighting over. So it's not yet clear who's going to win that fight. They've been very successful so far at avoiding having to actually make a final call on that, they won't be anymore. The rubber has now hit the road. And then the question is, if they ask the Supreme Court to take it, will the court jump in? Hard to think that they won't. I mean, the Supreme Court has taken all five post-9/11 terrorism cases where the government lost in the Court of Appeals and asked the court to step in. Then the question really becomes, where are the votes on the court? Is Justice Kennedy, who wrote a very, I think, telling concurring opinion on military commissions when Hamdan was at the court in 2006, is he still where he was then? Because if so, I think the government's got an uphill road to climb. Assuming that this stays intact, either because the court doesn't take the case or they affirm, I think this really puts the kibosh on most of the commissions. You know, if you take the D.C. Circuit literally, all the commissions can do is try standalone international war crimes. And so the 9/11 trial, the case against the five defendants most directly associated with 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and their three colleagues, that goes forward. Those are clearly war crimes. There are two other pending cases, al-Nashiri for the bombing of the USS Cole. There's a question there about whether an attack that was committed in 2000 before 9/11 can be tried by a military commission. So that has baggage all its own. And then there's one other case right now, a guy named al-Hadi, who's charged with perfidy, like a false flag operation from 2005. That probably goes forward. But I don't know how there are any other cases that they can bring at this point. And so we may very well look back at the end of the day, look at this billion-dollar enterprise, the Guantanamo Military Commissions, and see two successful cases. That's a lot of money to spend for two convictions.
As compared to what we've seen in the federal courts.
Absolutely. I mean, as Judge Tatel points out in his concurrence in al-Bulul, there are over 200 documented prosecutions of terrorism-related offenses in the Article III civilian courts since 9/11. I don't think it will surprise anyone that the government has a remarkably high batting average in these cases, or that federal judges in these cases hand down exceptionally stiff sentences. And so I think, you know, one of the things that's worth pointing out is whatever one thinks of the legal issues raised by these commissions, as a purely practical matter, if the 9/11 trial had proceeded in the Article III courts as Attorney General Holder said they would and then backed off in 2010, those guys would be on death row by now.
So that takes us, I think, to kind of a final concluding point. Unfortunately, it seems likely that there will be future acts of terrorism against the United States. We will probably be in a situation where we have people in custody who we believe were involved in those acts. So we're going to have to get this right. Why is it so important for the United States to get this right in a way that, and this comes through in your writings, that is faithful to the rule of law and to America, you know, as a constitutional republic?
It's the great question. It's the right question. I think that the best way I can answer that is just to say the reason why international law only tolerates military commission prosecutions for international war crimes is reciprocity. And the concern that any one country could come up with its own list of domestic war crimes that all of a sudden American soldiers would be subject to prosecution for, or British soldiers, et cetera. Part of preserving the rule of law means preserving the rule of law as applied to us elsewhere. And it seems to me that we should be invested in precedents that allow for reciprocity, that don't subject us to the same kind of weird one-sided view of criminal prosecutions. And perhaps most importantly, it's also worth reminding folks, and 9/11, when 9/11 happened, most of our most important criminal counterterrorism laws did not apply extraterritorially, which meant that even if we picked someone up on September 12th in Pakistan who we knew was involved in 9/11 attacks, we might have had a hard time actually prosecuting him. That's not true anymore. Congress has, for better or for worse, expanded all of our major terrorism offenses to apply overseas, which means that it is no longer necessary in any case for the government who picks up a new terrorism suspect to say, we need to prosecute them in a military commission. And so given the reciprocity concerns, given the rule of law concerns, given the practical ability and, I have to say, track record of the Article III courts, I don't know why, if you were a president of any partisan stripe, you wouldn't say immediately the Article III courts are the way to go now and going forward, whatever else you might say about the legacy cases at Guantanamo.
Well, that'll be the concluding note. Thank you so much, Steve, for coming in and discussing this fascinating case with us. And for Short Circuit, this is Clark Neely and Evan Burnick reminding you to get engaged at home and abroad.